Hey there, this is Bram Kanstein and you're listening to Bitcoin for Millennials. With the guests on my podcast, I go on a journey to discover how our current financial system works, why it's flawed, and why Bitcoin is the most relevant technological discovery you should understand and adopt. In this episode, I'm joined by Rune Oskaard. He's a Norwegian lawyer with 25 years of experience and an author. Two of his books, Fraudcoin and Unbar, are currently the most popular books in Norway in the economics category, and his next book, Arrow of Truth, will launch very soon. Rune's mission is to write and talk about the forgotten right to use the money we like best, which is monetary freedom, and how history teaches us that we always must fight against monopolies in money production. I'm excited to talk with him today, so welcome, Rune.
Thank you for having me, Bram. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming on. I love to talk with people that I just know from the internet. And also, I think very cool to see, you know, you have a long career being a lawyer. You know, I think this is a big team in Bitcoin that lots of different people from lots of different backgrounds, you know, start moving their energy towards Bitcoin. And I think with you, it's the same. So very, very interesting to see. I have a lot of questions about inflation. Thought it would be a nice topic to talk about. But first, I wanted to start with like a new segment that I want to introduce in the podcast, which is, you know, what is an interesting tweet, article, podcast, or video that you've come across recently that you love to share with the audience? Any content that caught your eye?
Oh, I read so much on Twitter X these days, but it's a while ago since I listened to anything on any podcast. No, I listened to an episode on what Bitcoin did the other day. It was from the cheat code conference that Peter McCormack hosted. I think it was a talk first with Lynn Alden and then a couple of other guys. That was a great episode. I would highly recommend that.
Yeah, nice.
Really high signal. So,
All right. Well, if you share it with me, I'll link to it in the show notes, and then you know, we can point people towards other content that's worth checking out. So, yeah, I wanted to talk about your book. It's called Fraudcoin: A Thousand Years with Inflation as a Policy. There are basically two different, like, economic schools of thought, and they talk differently about inflation. So we have Keynesian economics that I think a lot of people that are into Bitcoin or exploring Bitcoin have heard about. You know, they view moderate inflation as something that's beneficial, that drives demand, that reduces unemployment, that kind of like fuels an economy. And they support like active government intervention. And then you have the Austrian school, and they oppose this. They oppose the manipulation of money by central banks and governments, and because they argue it leads to like booms and busts. And they advocate for like commodity-based currencies and minimal government intervention. I do not have an economics background, and ever since like I started diving more into like finance and economics, you know, when I was in Bitcoin, just like the Austrian school made so much more sense to me, because it's very rational and it believes in human desires and human action. Where I think like Keynesian economics for me is very, it's like ruler driven, like, you know, we agreed to do this and we put a signature on this, so now you can trust us or something. Like there's no rational arguments there. But I wanted to ask you, can you elaborate a bit on these economic schools, how you view them, and why we are still stuck in a Keynesian economics world instead of moving to, I think, what I and a lot of Bitcoiners think is a more sensible approach to economics?
Yeah, as you know, I'm not an economist myself, but some 20 plus years ago, I started to read a lot of economics. I tried some of the standard textbooks which are being used on the universities in economics courses. found it difficult for me to understand it, because basically it was too much mathematics, and I'm not very good at mathematics, I have to admit. And I really felt that it made sense to me. It wasn't intuitive to understand those textbooks. I tried to read both macroeconomics and microeconomics, and found it really hard. Then I discovered a man who is named Ronald Coase. He has won the prize in memory of Alfred Nobel some years ago. I wonder if it was in the 90s or something like that. And Ronald Coase, he wrote a lot about property rights, things that made quite a lot of sense to me. And then I started reading Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. And Ayn Rand, she is a philosopher, but she understood quite a lot of economics. And it turned out she had learned economics from Ludwig von Mises himself. And that led me to Austrian economics. So around 2003 or something like that, I started to discover Murray Rothbard and Friedrich von Hayek. And you know, these guys, they write not only about the mechanisms involved in economics, but they have a very broad view. They link it together with history, and it feels like it's really a social science and much less mathematics, mostly arguing from sort of first principles point of view. So the method was really different. And if we just jump forward to Fraudcoin, when I wrote Fraudcoin, it was launched in 2022, I thought I will have to talk a little bit about the differences between Keynesian economics and Austrian school. And what's most important is to understand that there was a change in the way you're thinking about economics in around 1920s, when suddenly the natural sciences, that was on the back of a period of a whole lot of technical progress and innovation and so on. And I think that people really strongly believed in the natural sciences then, and that you would find all the answers there. So they tried to implement it into also the social sciences, using statistics and a sort of a laboratory way of thinking on economic problems. And then they started to also become they became influenced by the idea of the state trying to plan the economy. And this was probably a direct result of what happened in the Soviet Union with the revolution they had there, and they started to have this extreme level of central planning in the economy, and they probably spewed out a lot of false statistics, trying to sort of impress the Western countries and the rest of the world with how successful they were. And it really seems to me that many of the economists and the universities were influenced by this way of thinking, and they didn't manage to see through the lies that came out of Kreml, because it was purely propaganda. I also describe in Fraudcoin how this came about, how this change came about due to the influence that came from the Rockefeller Foundation, because they started to provide financial aid, for instance, to the University of Oslo. So the university in Oslo was able to set up an economics department, which was fully financed by the Rockefeller Foundation. And sort of the statutes of the foundations, of the fund, it said that they had to get rid of the old way of thinking in economics and the social sciences, and focus a lot more on using real science, using the methods from the natural sciences with the testing and using statistics and using the state more or less as a lab.
Hey there, thanks so much for listening to this episode. I just really want to ask you for a quick favor. Over the last few months, I've seen that only 75% of people who listen to this podcast or watch it on YouTube are actually subscribed. The most important thing I'm currently focusing on, next to hopefully giving you interesting conversations, is growing this podcast subscriber base so I can continue with it into the future. I want to thank everyone who has been viewing and listening to Bitcoin for Millennials, leaving comments here and sending me DMs. It's been super, super motivating. So thank you so much. So I really want to ask you to please hit the subscribe button on YouTube or follow me on your favorite podcasting app if you are enjoying this podcast. Thanks again for joining me on this journey. Now back to the conversation.
But is that still how they use it? Like,
it's
for me, it feels like they try to model human behavior. They try to put human behavior in certain buckets or something, in a sense, right? Like they try to influence the behavior. And sorry to interrupt, but my thought is also like, I don't know all this history, for example, right? It's just, if you look at it from an objective point of view, it feels like you, at least for me, should have people pick and choose what they want to spend money on or what they want to produce or create, you know, like the human incentives of making money or earning a reward to pay for your life are in my mind already enough, you know. But it seems like that is kind of like out of the picture in a sense.
So basically, it just corrupted the whole subject of economics in a very short period of time, because one should be surprised at all by the fact that the politicians favored this new way of teaching economics, because it gave the state, the government, a much bigger role in the economics subject, and sort of they probably appreciated a lot that the state should have a leading role, you know, guiding the rest of the society, being an institution that should promote progress by scientific using a more scientific type of economics, and also all the power that followed with this kind of thinking. Of course, they supported this transition. So it didn't take many decades before they basically wiped out the Austrian School of Economics and their influence on this subject. And I think they were marginalized already before the Second World War. And I think this has continued all the way up to until perhaps the beginning of this millennium. I think the Austrian school got a revival perhaps a little bit before great financial crisis in 2008. So and since then it has been a much more positive development. So previously people didn't have any idea what Austrian economics was about at all. And now these days, you know, even fighters on the UFC talk about Ludwig von Mises. So, yeah, it makes me very positive, at least.
So it's very interesting to see. So if we dive into that a bit, you know, we just talked before we started recording, you know, like it seems like lots of people have heard about inflation. They also feel it in a sense. I told you, like, that if I talk to my friends, some say like, oh yeah, it just got a bit more expensive, but they don't really think about it. Other people really notice it, but they don't spend time to study like what is happening. They just think it's part of it. I don't actually know what they think, but they don't see the problem, I think, as I do. You know, they really don't care to dive in and understand how it influences their life. How would you define inflation in simple terms? How do you do that in a book?
So it has been a lot of discussions on what the proper definition of inflation is, and I'm not interested in semantics at all. I think we have to talk about the reality. It makes it so much fruitful, the discussions. So I just say in the book that I define inflation in the following way. You have monetary inflation, which is an increase in the money supply, so you grow the stock of money. And then you have price inflation, which is a general price increase, you know, that most prices go up. And then I say in Fraudcoin that you have a sort of a causality here. So if you, in order to have general price inflation over time, you depend on an expansion of the money supply, the monetary inflation. And it's as simple as that. It's nothing else than the monetary inflation that explains the price inflation in over longer periods of time. Yeah. It's very simple. Yeah.
So the more units of the currency you create, the less each unit has in value, the more units you have to ask for the same thing.
Yeah.
All right. So, and what sparked your interest in this topic? Why did you decide to write a book about it? And like what about the effects on society?
First of all, I realized many years ago that this is probably the most important of all political topics. If you can control the money supply and create money out of nothing, you can win almost every battle against the others, those who cannot enjoy controlling the money printer. It's very basic, actually. And I think probably I realized that people need to understand this. If this is the most important political subject of them all, then and people don't understand it, we don't learn about it in schools. Even economics students learn almost nothing about it, and there's a whole lot of false ideas being promoted about monetary policy in the economics textbooks. And also the financial students, they don't learn very much about it. So I thought this was the first time I wrote about this was back in 2008 when we had the great financial crisis, and very few people understood what the causes were, and they didn't understand the impact didn't understand how the way the central banks and the governments tried to deal with the financial crisis, how that would affect the economy and politics in the long term. So that was the first time I wrote about it in an op-ed for a regional newspaper here in Norway. And when we came to 2022 and the price inflation started to speed up in the Western world and then in the rest of the world as well, I thought perhaps I could expand on that op-ed and write a pamphlet or something about it. I showed the pamphlet to a friend of mine. He said, this is going to be one of the most important books in Norway if you make a book out of it. And he turned out to be right. So I think what made it much easier for people to understand it based on my presentation of the topic was that I, back in 2008, discovered how this transition happened in Norway from monetary freedom to monetary monopoly. And that happened in 1050, towards the very end of the Viking Age. And it's quite well described in the royal sagas and also in some other sources, with some dramatic events, with real people, with real names. And so sort of.
And so what happened there? I saw that part in the book, but you go back. How long ago is the Viking Age?
So the Viking Age ended in 1066 after Christ. And yeah, I've expanded on that also in my latest book in Anbar, and we'll write I write more, even more about it in Arrow of Truth, because I think it's important to understand the transition. So what happened, if I just go a little bit further back, what happened towards the end of the 9th century? The kings, they wanted to Christianize Norway. They wanted everybody to be baptized and accept Christianity and just give up their old religion. The old religions, they were, you know, they worshipped the Norse gods like Thor and Odin and a whole lot of gods. And then everything with regards to religion was decentralized. It was decentralized in terms of they had many gods. They worshipped their gods on the farms, not in big churches or in any centralized place. It was sort of the landowner or the farmer himself who led the rituals so everything was decentralized. And then the kings, they wanted probably to use religion as a political tool. So they wanted to have them believe in one God. And the kings, they wanted to be sort of their religious leader in their respective countries. So in the beginning, they tried to convince the Norwegians about adopting Christianity voluntarily, but especially my people in the middle part of Norway, which is called Trøndelag, they didn't accept this new religion. And in 995, a king named Olav Tryggvason started to force the new religion upon them by christening them by sword, so to speak, and kidnapped the sons of the most powerful farmers around here and kept them hostage. And over time, they succeeded more and more in convincing the people that they had to give up their old religion. And in parallel, they tried to introduce a monopoly in coinage. So they produced coins with the king's symbol on one hand and the Christian cross on the other side of the coin. But they didn't succeed in doing this. They were the first king, Olav Tryggvason, who tried this. He was killed in a battle in, I think it was in year 1000. And then later another king came, and he was chased out of the country by the farmers and people who lived there. He came back in 1030. He also had tried to introduce monopoly in coinage, and Christianized people by using sword violence, coercion. So he was killed in 1030. But at that time, the people, they were really tired of this battle against Christianity, and the pressure was too much for them to bear. So they just accepted Christianity, and when a new king, Harald Hardrada, he's known as the last Viking king. When he took power as a sole sovereign in 1047, then most of the country had been, they had converted, most people had converted to Christianity. And he promoted himself as the sole leader of the church. He was sort of above the church itself. And then he started to introduce monopoly in coinage. We don't know the exact year, but we think he perhaps tried to start a little bit before 1050. But he didn't succeed in implementing his scheme until after he had managed to kill the most powerful man in Norway. He lived in my region here. His name was Einar Tambarskjelve. So he killed him, and then he set out to force his monopoly and exploited the people. So he probably tripled the money supply in less than 16 years. And he did it to finance the battle against the Danish king. He wanted to reclaim the control over Denmark, because Denmark had been part of the Norwegian Empire before 1047. And what happened then actually was that when the Danish king saw that Harald Hardråda financed his warring against Denmark with the monetary policy, basically almost creating money out of nothing with his silver coin scheme. Harald Hardråda, he forced everybody to use his coins, so people had to come to his mint and give their silver to his mint, and the mint gave some coins back to them, but they didn't include all of the silver that the mint had received. So it was sort of a silver tax that the mint could use to produce coins for the king. So what most likely happened was that the Danish king understood that in order for him to defend himself, he would have to do exactly the same thing in Denmark against his own people. So we know that the first debasement of Danish coins happened around, it could have been 1056, 1057 or something like that, when the war was going on with Norway. But they managed to cut a peace deal, I think it was towards the end of the 1050s. And then this ambitious king, Harald Hardråda, he was an evil tyrant. He turned his attention to England and wanted to conquer England. And in 1066, he tried to do that unsuccessfully. And he lost about 5,000 men and was killed himself as well at the Battle of Stamford Bridge, wow. The famous battle there. So it's a very dramatic history, and it's important to understand the link between the belief system and which religion is a part of, and the monetary policy. It's also one thing I didn't mention. It was that here in Trøndelag, we had what we call the resistance provisions, which meant that a king who wanted to increase the taxes, he would have to get a green light and acceptance for that from the local, the regional thing where the farmers and those who had who owned land, they were the ones in power there. So if they didn't accept his proposal, then he wouldn't be able to increase the taxes. And the law actually said that if the king took someone's property without having got a green light from the Frosta thing, then they were obliged to try to kill him. Everybody were obliged to try to kill him. All of the people in Trøndelag were obliged to try to kill him. And if they weren't successful in doing that, they were obliged to chase him out of the country. And this is probably a tradition which has been in place in Trøndelag, in my area, for I would guess for thousands of years. And I suspect, but we don't know much about it, I think this has been the same principle almost all over the world before we got centralized institutions like the state. So, and you know, it's like a general conscription in service of the people themselves instead of conscription in service of the state. It's the very opposite of the system we have today. And this was probably a fundamental part of the belief system that they had at that time. They understood that if they gave an inch to a king, they would lose it all.
Mm.
So when we come to 1050 and everybody or most people are they have been baptized, they believe in Christianity, they see a ruthless king who's also the sole leader of the religion. And then it's probably much harder for the people to sort of agree with each other that they will have to go after the king and kill him. You know, in accordance with the Christian religion, perhaps they thought that they would end up in hell instead of being heroes as they would have been under the previous type of belief system.
Yeah.
So the belief system changed dramatically over just a period of just 60 years or something like that. And in the same period, two kings first then tried to introduce monopoly and coinage, and then a third king came were able to succeed with that monetary policy scheme. And after that, we have had almost a 1,000 years of inflation as a policy in Norway. And that's the reason why that is the subtitle of my book, 1,000 Years with Inflation as a Policy.
Yeah. So many things to unpack here. But I think what I find interesting is that if you have a sole leader, and they look for control of the coinage, right, of the money, basically, to, one, you know, get more for themselves. You know, they create more for themselves than they mint, basically, or what the people trade in. I think that's one. But then you also have a vehicle to tax people, right, from their productivity, basically. So you work for the king, but what does the king do for you? And there I find it interesting, like what you said. I for me, it makes a lot of sense that there was like this super transparent agreement in a sense, right? Like, okay, you rule over us, but you are accountable to such and such degree, right? Like that is also a little sidestep, but I like that. I don't know if you watched Peaky Blinders. But
yes, I love that series.
It's, what I love about it is that, you know, this is early 1920s. Everyone is violent. Everyone has a gun, right? But they're not shooting each other constantly. It's about, you know, if you and I make a deal and we spit in our hand and we shake each other's hand, we both know that if I try to mess with you, right? If I don't want to uphold my end of the deal, I accept that you can shoot me. And you see that multiple times in the show, right? Like, and also that they do try to mess with each other, but then, you know, eventually they get killed. And of course, it's very brutal, right? We don't want to start shooting people in the street, which is horrible, of course. But like the transparency of the agreement in like in that era always really fascinated me, because it's just very clear, right? We can be mutually beneficial, or I can try to mess up whatever we agree, you know, but then I'm also in big trouble, right? So it's a very conscious choice to either conform to our agreement or try to mess with you, but then I'm also, you know, 100% okay with the consequences. It's a very conscious decision, right? And I think your example of the king, I think it's kind of the same, right? If that rule of that everyone is obligated to then kill the king, you know, if he messes with the citizens, you know, if that is very clear to everyone, including the king, then perhaps it's fine that there is some sort of hierarchy, but there is a checks and balances type of situation, right? So that's kind of what I had to think about. But if we put this to like the current time, one thing I think about is like, you talk about the past, right? This is 1,000 years ago. People were, you know, barbarics and stuff like that. That's kind of how we think about the past, I think, right? And a lot of times when we think about the past, you know, kings tried to control the coins, so they got richer, right? I mean, it's even in Game of Thrones, for example, right? Like the Lannisters, they own the bank, right? And they own the money, whatever. But like, a lot of people look at how certain rulers in the current day rule, but they don't connect that to the history, kind of. Like, it feels like the history is far away. It's fiction, you know? Like, it doesn't happen like that, where, you know, 1,000 years ago, the people that lived then were exactly the same as us, right? With the same wants and needs and virtues and flaws and all these things, right? So how I think about that is like, these people are no different. Like that system is no different, right? And it would make a lot of sense that you would pitch your citizens why you want to raise taxes, what you're going to spend it on, how it benefits their lives, before they actually start giving you money. I would also like to think about this, you know, if the leaders of now can just create money, why do we pay taxes? You know, like, I think that's such a funny thought. But like, what do you think is like the biggest lesson we can take out of that story? Maybe that nothing ever really changes, and we are perhaps in a same situation, or yeah.
Okay, I think the most important thing is how we frame this from an analytical perspective, because we see that the monetary freedom that they had until about 1050, it was safeguarded on the basis, or it was safeguarded by a belief system where everybody were obliged to fight against the king, and nobody could be a free rider. If you were a free rider, you threatened the whole system, because it would infect all the others who wanted to fight, but who saw that someone tried to not join the fight. So, it to me, that's one of the most important lessons, that people understood that they would have to fight together, and also that nobody would do the fighting for them. You couldn't leave it to others to provide your security. You had to fight for it yourself. You couldn't rely on anyone else to safeguard your freedom. Everybody would have to join the fight. That's sort of a fundamental way of thinking.
Yeah.
A core value of the society. And once you sort of leave that kind of thinking and start to say that, well, perhaps it's good that we have a king that can take care of us, that can protect us against the foreign enemies, etc. Then perhaps I will have to accept that he taxes me, although I don't want to pay his taxes that much.
Yeah.
And perhaps I will have to accept that he monopolizes the money production, that you get this royal privilege in.
Well, because you chose not to fight, right? That's yes. Then the consequence. I find it interesting.
So you have a very close link between the belief system and the monetary system. So I call the belief system layer 0 and the monetary system layer 1. And the reason why the monetary system is layer 1 is that you get such a different civilization or society with a monetary system based on the principle of monetary freedom compared to a monetary system based on monopoly. So once you understand that all those other layers in society will develop in very different ways depending on what type of monetary system you have, you see that the analytical framework should be, or at least a sort of the rough idea with my analytical framework is that it all starts with the belief system, and then you get the monetary system, and then the rest of the society develops depending on the monetary system.
Yeah.
Because what happens if you monopolize the money production? The very first thing that a king will spend his money on is more weapons, and then he will also hire more soldiers. And once he is able to have more soldiers, a bigger army, more weapons, then immediately it becomes so much easier to increase the taxes, to force the will upon the people. And in addition, of course, the king will corrupt the society by hiring people and making deals with merchants, etc. So he sort of builds up slowly a support based on his spending of the money. And there's what we see today is that there is no end in how much they will expand, increase the taxes. For instance, in Norway now we have a public sector that spends almost 2/3 of the GDP.
Oh, really?
So it's enormous. I guess if you account for the black market in the Soviet Union, I think it would be something similar nowadays in Norway, because the black market was really huge in Soviet Union, and that country wouldn't have functioned at all without that large black market. So. Yeah, it begins with the belief system, and then you get the monetary system, and then the rest of society develops in accordance with what type of monetary system you have. So that pretty much sums up why I think it's so important to understand inflation, where it comes from, and what the root cause is. Because we can't expect that we will be able to do anything with this problem if we don't understand the root cause of the problem. So many Bitcoin, perhaps we should switch to Bitcoin now a little bit, because many Bitcoiners seem to think that stacking sats, that's sufficient. That's sort of a way of fighting against the enemy, against the state. But I don't think it's sufficient. If we are going to succeed with our project, we should view Bitcoin as a very useful instrument, a tool, a weapon, if you want. But we have to work with the belief system of the people. Yeah. We have to make people understand that if you are a free rider, or if you leave it to others to fight your cause, fight for your freedom, then you will never be free. You can't just trust that a monetary technology will set you free automatically.
Yeah.
That's never going to happen in my view, at least.
Yeah. Well, before we move on to Bitcoin, I wanted to reflect on what you just said, because there was one thing that made me think of Bitcoin, you know, like what you said, if there are no free riders, or there were no free riders back in the day, right? Everyone agreed to the rule of fighting against the king because everyone agreed to the rule to fight against the king, basically.
Hmm.
Right? You knew that everyone agreed, therefore you agreed, kind of.
Hmm.
I feel the same thing in Bitcoin. Like when you think about the rules of Bitcoin, right? Like, and I've said this over and over again, like I think anyone listening to this who is studying Bitcoin, etc., you don't have to trust any person that talks on this podcast. Not me, not you, not anyone. The fact that you can verify everything about how Bitcoin works, that's the entire point of Bitcoin. It's extremely transparent and open, and you can look up any rules, any code, anything, basically. And then you can decide to participate in it. And when you decide to participate in it, which is, you know, it's voluntarily a decision instead of being ruled, you know, by force by a king, for example. And I think when you say king, it's just the ruler of the country, whether your country, you know, has a king currently or not. But I think that voluntary choice of using Bitcoin as money, and therefore also following the rules of Bitcoin, that signals to other people that it's a trustworthy thing, in my opinion, right? Mm. Because it's so open. I mean, you know, in the book you talk about how our financial system is based on trust, right? That's also what the economists say, right? They say it's built on trust.
Actually, I argue against that statement in the book, because I say that the foundation for the monetary system that we have today is, first of all, two things. Not trust, but coercion,
mm-hmm,
and deception.
Yeah, I say coercion, uninformed. Deception. I say uninformed, forced trust. You know, it's not optional.
Yeah,
you know, it's not optional, it's dictated, right? Mm. And I think, to go back to your beginning, like how I learned about economics in high school, again, after that, it was all about calculating stuff, right? And I've talked to, also on the podcast, with a lot of people who are in economics. I think one episode is with Leon Wankum. He's a master of economics. And he told me, I never learned what money is in my entire study, you know? And so it's not weird that people just conform to whatever the money is, right? Like, I have a young son, I give him coins, he goes to a store, he gets a thing. Yeah, okay, you know, like that works. So you never really trust it. But later, if you reflect upon it, like, did you ever choose the money that you use? No. You know, and do you understand how it works? Also no. Are there people who benefit from the creation of the money and you don't? That's correct. You know, like all these things sounds crazy to a lot of people, but they are true, you know. And I'm just so fascinated by the following question is, why don't more people question this? Like, why? And there, maybe to add to that, also to what you just said, I feel it's sometimes really like a spiritual type of thing. Right, it's like, how good do we know ourselves, right? If we do business and I do something for you, that's you trusting me, that's me spending my time, that's me spending my energy, me maybe, you know, how do you say, actually building an idea I have for you, I don't know, a house or, you know, whatever. Like, it's a connection between two people, this a value exchange, right? But that's influenced by the thing we use to represent the value. That's influenced by people that don't care that, you are you and I am me, you know? And I feel that this is such a huge thing. Like, what do you spend your finite amount of time on of your life, you know, and how are you rewarded for that? Hmm. And people just don't really think about it, but I wanted to ask your opinion on it. Like, why don't people do that?
It's probably many reasons, but of course, is, you know, I've been going to attending school and university for a total of 18 years, and I didn't learn a shit about money, just like most people who have a lot of education. So you don't learn about how important it is, the monetary system, how important money is to the people. Then, but we learn a ton about other things that they tell us are important, you know, which, for instance, politics in general, that we have to be active, actively participating in the democratic processes, etc. That we should read the newspapers. That was very important when we went to school. So it's probably more about being used to talk about all the other things than money. Mm. And then you have two other aspects of it. I think, first of all, at least in this part of the Western world, money is sort of seen as the root of all evil. And if it's the root of all evil, then you rather don't want to talk about it because it's a negative thing. It's just money is something that you just need. I don't want to learn more about it. I need money. I earn money. I save a little bit of money. It's okay. I don't want to learn about it. It's almost like you don't want to learn too much about rats either. Everybody hates rats. You don't want to talk about it. You don't want to learn about it. And then the third thing is if you try to understand where money comes from and monetary policy, then what should you do about the knowledge you get? It's a sort of an external thing, something that most people would think they can't do anything about it. It just exists. It's a policy. It's been there for 1,000 years. How can I do anything to affect that? It's like the weather. It just appears. Today it's sunny. Yesterday it was raining. It's an what do you call it? An exogenic factor or something like that.
But so, isn't that the layer zero you talked about? Also in connection what I just said, like the instead of agreeing as a group to follow certain rules or what we agree to, it's kind of like people outsourced their responsibility over their life. They are totally okay with it. And then, you know, it's easy. So they don't question it. Is that... Then probably, maybe the layer zero that we live
money,
on.
Yeah, like the idea is, might be for some people that money is too complex. We better leave it to the experts. Other can handle this, take care of monetary policy things in a way that helps my is good for my life. I expect that they will do that. I'm not supposed to be responsible for looking into that. I leave it to others. That makes sense.
It's fascinating. That's also why I said a spiritual thing, right? Because then it's kind of like, again, the example of me doing something for you. We have a value exchange that is just you and me in all freedom. You know, we can pick and choose whoever we have a value exchange with, but then a third party influences the reward that is exchanged there, right? Or the quality of the work that is done, therefore, as well. And I think that is what I then mean about like outsourcing that responsibility. Like, you know, something influences your life, but you decide to be ignorant and look away because it's easier, you know, for me, that's more like a spiritual thing. That's really like a Matrix thing, right? If you know that it is different, but you decide to ignore it. But that also gives you a hard life, I'd say. It's, you know, the easy choice, hard life thing, because you cannot really complain about it. Then maybe you have to fight it. But then, well, you get to that kind of crossing point to, okay, I, how do you say, like, gave my responsibility away my whole life, and now I have to fight. You know, like, that sounds very very daunting, you know. So, I mean, I do get it that a lot of people don't study it. I mean, I didn't study it for the first 30 years of my life. So, I mean, that's, that's also the case. So, what? How do you see Bitcoin playing a role in, like, future monetary policies? Do you think it could help combat, you know, bad policies that create inflation? How does Bitcoin prove that you can trust, you know, its monetary policy?
You know, I come from the angle that I analyze money, the monetary system, monetary policy from a sort of a social point of view, not a technological point of view. Many people start with the question, what is money? And they dive into how different types of money developed over time, and that silver and gold sort of won the battle, became the most popular commodity money. And then fiat money just sort of happened to be a better technology, so to speak, and it naturally led to where we are today, and perhaps that also naturally led to the development of privately created digital currencies, and then in the end, Bitcoin as a sort of a very promising freedom technology and monetary technology. But the way I see it as is that just like silver coins, gold coins, Bitcoin is really, it's like a fundamentally neutral matter. It's a dead thing. It only is brought into life when we humans start to use it, when we start to understand it. So all the value that we will get out of Bitcoin will come from the way we use Bitcoin, the way we think about Bitcoin, the way we talk about Bitcoin, the way we let Bitcoin influence us philosophically, with regard also to how we try to use it to understand and perhaps improve our values. So I think Bitcoin develops 100% on the social layer. And that's also why when I discovered Bitcoin just before I launched Fraudcoin in 2022, I was fascinated by the social layer of Bitcoin. That was the main thing that caught my eye, that I saw that I shared the same values as the Bitcoin maxis. I felt really at home from a philosophical perspective. And I saw that I immediately understood that that's where the growth is going to come from. People who understand it and want to make other people understand it. So what strikes me is that we have this fantastic technology, and it really attracts the best and the brightest of people. It's like a torch in the dark. It glows, and people just, they want to understand what this is. And it just grows and grows. And so my idea is that if we work hard together and try to embody some of the older values, which were prevalent when we had monetary freedom, that will help us to make this social layer of Bitcoin grow. And by doing that, make Bitcoin become much more valuable and much more quickly. But if we don't understand the connection between the belief system and the monetary system, then we'll lose speed compared to a situation where we do understand it.
Yeah. So how would you define the current belief system then?
I talked about this when I visited the What Bitcoin Did podcast and talked to Peter McCormack. And I said that we have seen a transition from people believing in themselves to people believing in Christian religion, one God. We became very religious over a period of many, many centuries. And then people started to believe in the state. So the state has become sort of a religion by itself, and it has pretty much replaced Christianity in the Western world as a religion.
Yeah.
This is sounds very, very dark, of course, but the state has expanded so at such a dramatic speed, and now people start to understand, more and more people start to understand that there's something fundamentally wrong with the system today.
Yeah.
So I think at this moment in time, people are very ready, very sort of receptive to the idea that we have to look back in time and try to understand the traditions we had and how our belief system shaped society back then. I think people understand, more and more people understand that actually they had quite a good life back then. They didn't have all those technologies that we have today, everything that we take for granted today. But they lived a very healthy life. At least most people in my area here in Trøndelag. And just by coincidence, I discovered the meaning of Trønder. Trønder, that's the people, my people, we are called Trønders.
Oh, wow.
And I read about it in an article just a few months ago. It means fertile and strong. And this cool. hasn't been taught in our schools, not at all. We haven't heard anything about it, what is my people? It was shocking to me.
Yeah.
And also at the same time, I felt pride. I felt very proud of sort of discovering what this was all about, perhaps some 1,000 years ago when we were powerful and fought back against evil kings and fought together. And probably they had a very good life here. We have all the resources we need here in Trøndelag. We have rivers, we have woods. It's the soil is very fertile. We can grow everything we need here. We don't need the rest of Norway. We don't need the rest of the world. We have everything we need here, yeah. And we protected our resources very effectively 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
If we are able to rediscover what we had perhaps a long time ago, I think it will be exactly the same in the Netherlands where you live. If you look back in time, for instance, the revolt in 1566, when you reintroduced monetary freedom in the Netherlands, and you got the golden age. I write about this also in Fraudcoin. When you understand how much that meant to you to rediscover monetary freedom,
yeah,
it sort of helps a lot to spread the word about Bitcoin as well. I think it might be better to promote Bitcoin indirectly, in my experience, and talk about the positive things with monetary freedom and the bad things about monetary monopoly and how the latter affects society, and then sort of introduce Bitcoin as a possible tool which can and let us win back monetary freedom in the end.
Yeah,
that's a better approach, at least from what my experience is when I talk to people who don't understand anything about money or Bitcoin or anything like that.
Yeah. Do you think we are we are far away from that? Like, for me, this, what you just said, I think it's very hopeful, right? It's very positive view of what people together can do. Again, kind of like the spiritual angle, but I think lots of people are very, very nihilistic these days. Like things don't work. It's all bad. I cannot influence this, etc. You know, without understanding that. Well, maybe it was an unconscious choice for most, but for some also definitely a conscious choice to ignore, right? But to get to this hopeful part and future outlook, you first have to accept that you are in, you know, a dark part of dark part of time, I think, you know, and that's hard for people. So they rather say like, well, I can just, you know, I cannot change this, or, you know, whatever, like, you know, the nihilistic outlook. Like, how far do you feel like we are away from this? Very far or not too far? Like, no?
I'm very optimistic, but of course I'm being sort of colored by my own journey here, because I didn't discover Bitcoin before 2022, very, very late, unfortunately. There are many reasons for that, but after the Bitcoin community embraced Fraudcoin, and I found a sort of family there, things have been moving very quickly for me. So my change, my life has changed dramatically just in a period of 1.5 years. So, for instance, I had never been on a podcast before November 2022, and now I've been guesting, I think, 37 podcasts or something like that.
Nice.
Yeah, and I've been invited to give presentations in the, and participating in a in panels in Madeira, you know, the Bitcoin Atlantis conference. I think you were there too, weren't you?
Yeah, you were there this year. Oh, we missed each other.
Yes, and now Matthias in Prague invited me to give a keynote presentation, or not keynote, but 20 minutes presentation on the main stage in Prague this year in June. And so those are big things for me to experience. I think many people are very receptive to the ideas that I promote, and not only in the Bitcoin community, but now I surprisingly was invited to give the key speech when we celebrate Constitution Day on 17th of May here in Norway. So I'm going to give the speech for my local community, and I'm going to talk to the children and the youth, especially there, about the relationship between the Constitution and the monetary policy. The central bank was sort of founded in Norway based on the constitution, and people really, everybody in Norway that or not everybody but so many different parts of Norway now wants me to talk about this. They are very receptive to this. Many podcasts here in Norway, they want to talk to me about this, and so what I bring to the table is a positive idea. I think I say that if we can try to learn from our past, we will be able to win this battle. And then I say, I'm proud because I'm fighting this battle. and I want you to fight too, because it's the only right thing to do. If you don't fight, then you're by definition leaving it to others, and you're hoping that others will win the battle for you. Then you're a free rider. It's simple as that. It's a choice you will have to make. It's up to you. So people, I've seen so many dramatic wake-ups after they have written, they have read my books or heard me speak. And they say that, Rune, you have changed the way I think of life. So me being in sort of in the center of these events, you know, I'm in the center of my life, and just like you are in the center of your life. And the speed that this train that I embarked upon 1.5 year ago, it's sort of... it's so fast now. So I'm not objective, but what I experience is very, it makes me very optimistic. I think I'm going to continue to be an optimist for the rest of my life. And I don't see any other way out either. If you are nihilistic or negative, you're pessimistic, you won't be able to make any change.
Yeah.
So I don't feel that I have a choice.
Yeah.
And we will be able to do this together if we stand together.
Yeah, 100% agree. I do think, you know, of course, we should talk about the things that are not okay, but we do have an outlook, you know, as to how we can change it. And 100% align with what you say. I think it's very, it feels very natural, at least for me. Seems also for you, you know, like to share how Bitcoin changed your view on the world or taught you new things or shows you, you know, how we can actually create a more positive and hopeful future. And I think the act of doing something, whether it's writing a book or doing keynotes or making a podcast, I think, at least for me, it came very natural. It's not, it's like, I want to do this. Like, I want to contribute to this because I see what this can be. But I also understand, you know, I don't like it when people say, you know, it's inevitable, etc. Like, we have to, you know, we have to work for it, basically. That's definitely what you're doing. So what would you say is like, what has been the biggest change in your worldview because of Bitcoin? What's the biggest thing you change your mind about?
That's a very good answer, and the answer question and the answer is so simple, because I had almost given up when before I discovered the Bitcoin community. And meeting the Bitcoiners in person and also on the internet, on Twitter, other places, and understanding that there are so many people out there who have the same values as me, and they want to join the fight, to be sort of a force for good. That was a life-changing experience for me. It might be the most important thing that has happened to me in my life. I imagine that a whole lot of other Bitcoiners feel exactly the same. It's very rewarding, and you also feel definitely feel a lot of gratitude. I feel lucky to be alive at this moment. Yeah. And although I haven't been able to stack up so much Bitcoin as I would like to, everybody would like to have more Bitcoin, of course, but I've been working with books now for 3 years. I haven't been able to afford a lot of Bitcoin investments. But I feel more and more sort of based, because I've found more reason in life, and that sort of calms me down a whole lot.
Yeah. I have the same. That calms me down. I think it's because you learn that you can actually trust yourself, which is like a really big thing, you know? And I don't know, like I feel I'll figure it out or something, you know? It's kind of the baseline approach, yeah. But like, if you don't mind me asking, what do you mean with like you gave up? Like, what do you mean by that? What changed?
Okay, so I sort of, between 2002 and 2008, 9, 10 or something like that, I really got so much new knowledge and understanding by studying economics and the Austrian School of Economics and trying to understand money. But I was so alone. I didn't have anyone to talk to about these issues here in Norway. And when I tried to talk about it with friends and family, they sort of shrugged their shoulders and they didn't want to discuss these items. It was a nuisance, you know. Now Rune is talking about these things again. So it was a sort of, yeah, it wasn't good at all. And then I had a personal experience in 2010, which we don't have the time to talk about here now, but I just gave up on being active and trying to influence others, and I just gave up on politics. I didn't follow the news for 10 years before the pandemic broke out in 2020. So I had so many years approximately 10 years when I went back to be a normie, as someone who was just an ordinary citizen, you know, working as a lawyer, being a family man, being active in my cycling club, doing things like that, and never thinking about politics or money or anything like that, just earning and spending and so being and living a normal life. And then it was very negative, of course, that we had this big problem with the inflation from 2022, but it inspired me to start to write about this again then. So that's the sort of the silver lining, as they say in English. I hear that the batteries in my earbuds are beginning to protest. So
let's wrap it up. Two questions. What do you hope readers will take away from the book?
I think readers, this will be the first half of the orange pill, I think, because I write only two pages about Bitcoin in the book, so I promote the conclusion in the book is that we should fight for monetary freedom, and that Bitcoin and also perhaps gold could be sort of a very important tool for people. In order to battle the consequences of inflation in their individual lives, I think it can have an impact both in Norway and outside of Norway. It has been translated into English and Polish, and the German versions are on their way as well. So I think it can have an impact in terms of orange pilling. Many people. So the conclusion, or to conclude, I think when people read Bitcoin, they won't only get a whole lot of new knowledge, but they will get a whole lot of new understanding of how society works, and a whole lot of understanding of the importance of the monetary system. they will feel it because I've focused so much on presenting real figures, you know, real people, and follow the development of monetary policy on the basis of describing what real people did in this and that country. It sort of makes the whole history come alive. It's not a dry theoretical subject anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Awesome. So last question, and I ask everyone the same question. What is a core belief you will never let go?
I think it must be that freedom and sovereignty is something that it's not only worth fighting for, but you are morally obliged fighting for it. And if you don't fight for it, then everything else don't sort of make any sense to me, at least. Yeah. Without freedom and sovereignty, what's all the rest worth? Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. Thanks for sharing and thanks for this conversation. I will link to your online profiles and the book so people can check it out. And yeah, man, let's keep in touch and perhaps we see each other at a conference in the future.
Great. Thanks for having me. And it's been a great, it's been great talking to you. So yeah, see you later.
Cheers. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, it would be amazing if you could rate, review, and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. It will help us educate more millennials on the importance of Bitcoin. You can follow and connect with me on Twitter. I'm Bram K. That's at BRAMK. And if you are or know someone who has an interesting perspective on Bitcoin that's worth sharing, hit me up. I read and reply to every single message. I appreciate your support and hope you'll be here for the next episode. Thanks for listening. Bye.